Welcome to the Woodridge Baptist Church Podcast. For more information about what's happening in the life of our church, visit our website at www.woodridge.org. Enjoy the podcast.
All right, good day. As we begin again, Acts. We took I guess it was a week and a half off. And now we're back to it. We'll continue in Acts 22 this morning, or this afternoon. It's probably a better way to say it. And actually do all of chapter 23. That may sound like a lot, and it is, but it's going to happen relatively quick based on, again, there's going to be some repetition that we've seen from other books that, or other parts of this book that we won't have to dive as deep into and go about it that way. So it'll be, I think, my own opinion, is that'll be an exciting time for everyone as we move through this today. Paul, for the most part, where we are, he's been stoned again, but is rescued again by the Romans before it goes really sideways. As he is being taken away, if you recall, he convinces the Roman commander, also known as the Tribune, to allow him to speak to this rowdy crowd to address them. And he then, what he likes to do, tells the full story. It's pretty much the Jewish version. I believe it's with Festus in a couple chapters from now, he's going to give them more of the Roman version of his story of his conversion on the road to Damascus, but he provides a Jewish version. And just like any good storyteller or anyone who's trying to explain a story, he puts it in the context of the people that are listening so they best understand what they need to hear. So he does that, and Luke's very good at telling us about how he did that. All was good until he brought up the point of the Gentiles, about how he was sent for the Gentiles, where he says there, where he says there in verse 21, that Jesus, for those of you who are following along in your scripture, you'll notice it's possibly in red if you have that version or that type of Bible. Others won't, but he'll say that what Jesus said, "Go, for I will send you far away to the Gentiles." And as you can imagine, for the most part, they were probably starting to listen to him because his story seemed legitimate. He was a Pharisee. He admitted that. He was a Jew. He admitted that. He was not the Egyptian rebel who had come years before to take the people out, or to actually take Rome out and to cause all the havoc there in Jerusalem. He was a Gentile and a Jew. I'm sorry, he was a Jew. He was a Pharisee, and he was there to continue the Jewish belief of having a Jewish Messiah. And that's where we have this disconnect, of course. We'll see a little bit more about that here in a minute. But the biggest disconnect, and as you can imagine, the distaste that Jews had for Gentiles, especially being under Gentile rule at this time by the Romans, was not good. And so you can imagine the reaction was pretty negative. And we see that here, and we'll start reading. Might as well just read the rest of chapter 22. It's verses 22 through 30 there in chapter 22. And we'll kind of see the reaction and what happens related to that, and how the best way for all of them to move forward. So here's how it goes. Ready? Here we go. They listened to him up to this statement, and they raised their voices and said, "Away with such a fellow from the earth, for he should not be allowed to live." So they want to have him killed. And as they were crying out and throwing off their cloaks and tossing dust into the air, you can just imagine what this was looking like. It's probably extremely dramatic and almost comical from a distance, if you did not know actually what was being said or done, but the amount of stuff. But then again, if you lived there during that time, it'd probably be comical to our own eyes here 2,000-ish years later, but not to them, because people, even from a distance, maybe from a tower far away or from another wall far away, saw the tossing of dirt and cloaks into the air, knew that something bad was happening. Many of them probably ran to that to see what was going on. But anyways, the commander ordered him to be brought into the barracks, stating that he should be examined by scourging so that he might find out the reason why they were shouting against him that way. Not a good idea, as we'll soon find out. But when they had stretched him out with thongs, Paul said to the centurion who was standing by, "Is it lawful for you to scourge a man who is a Roman and uncondemned?" When the centurion heard this, he went to the commander and told him, saying, "What are you about to do? For this man is Roman." The commander came and said to him, "Tell me, are you a Roman?" And he said, "Yes." The commander answered, "I acquired this citizenship with a large sum of money." And Paul said, "But I was actually born a citizen." And that's pretty significant here. We'll discuss that here in a minute. Therefore, those who were about to examine him immediately let go of him, and the commander also was afraid when he found out that he was a Roman, and because he had put him in chains. But on the next day, wishing to know why he had been accused by the Jews, he released him and ordered the chief priests and all the council to assemble and brought Paul down and set him before them. So Paul, the lucky guy that he is, I think he probably thought he was lucky. He gets to go before the council here again. They're starting in chapter 23. But before we get there, let's wrap up chapter 22 because it is fascinating. So as you can see, all was starting to settle down there as Paul was telling his story there in the outer court as he was probably up a set of stairs or maybe a couple set of stairs. Who knows? Anyways, he was able to address the outer court, and it was all good until he mentions his mission to the Gentiles. So as we look at verses 22 and 23, they become even more enraged, and you can imagine they've been dealing with these issues with Romans for a while. There's not a time really where they've really enjoyed being around Gentiles, but one of the a good reason being that they thought Gentiles were impure. They thought Gentiles were lesser of a people. They thought they were unclean and could cause all kinds of problems for the Jewish people. You have to think about from the perspective of the tribune or the commander, depending again on your translation. Paul is speaking to this crowd in Aramaic, and most likely the tribune would not know that. Probably knew Greek and Latin pretty well, and it seems like Paul did too. And it may have saved Paul some time and some almost flogging if he would have spoken in a language that the tribune would have understood, but he didn't. And the reason he most likely did not is because he was trying to prove to these Jews that he was a Jew. And by doing that, by speaking in Aramaic, he was able to do that. This idea of the cloaks and the being thrown around and the mud being thrown around is very similar to, like, I guess, mudslinging today, or, you know, throwing fruit at people or vegetables when they're on stage in kind of a more lighter way. But this is, they were an enraged group of people. In verse 24 there, the tribune wants to get to the bottom of the issue. And so the best way that Romans knew how to get to the bottom of the issues during that time was torture. And people to this day still try to get people to tell the truth through torture. And so he's trying to keep the peace in Jerusalem because that is his job. And he knows that's his job. And if he doesn't, he's in huge trouble with the governor. And we'll see how he kind of covers up some of this later on when he responds to or sends some information and a letter to Felix. It seems like this tribune, just based on what we know about him, just the context we can pick up from this, and then we do learn his name later on, is probably a young, up-and-coming type person who was, it seems here, was purchased his citizenship. Where he came from, it's really hard to tell, but it seems like he has some sort of possible Greek background based on his name. And so what he is trying to do here, he's the kind of thing of his own interest. The Romans didn't particularly care about what the Jews were up to unless the Jews were causing riots like this, and then they wanted to get to the bottom of it because they wanted to keep as much peace as possible, and knowing if they didn't keep peace, the emperor would be very upset with them, and they would probably be killed, or most likely killed, for allowing any sort of insurrection in whatever province or city that they were in charge of. So he's trying to make his way up in society and within the ranks of this group, and obviously already has if he's already a tribune over this large garrison there in Jerusalem. So he's trying to keep the peace. Ultimately, at the end of the day, he's trying to keep the peace there and trying to figure out who this guy is. The type of torture that they're talking about here is pretty wicked. The Latin word that's being used is flagellum, and that was it's pretty much an instrument of torture that was made out of leather straps or leather thongs and weighted with glass, stone, pieces of metal, typically anything hard and extremely painful that you could possibly think of. If you've ever seen the first season of Outlander, when Jamie Frazier gets beaten and his back is forever scarred because it rips into the tissues, into the muscle. It's a horrible, horrible punishment. And it typically would kill anyone that this happened to. So Paul was on the verge of being killed again, not by Jews this time, but by Romans again. And anyways, it's a horrible, horrible type of torture. And it's something that continued on for centuries later, even after the fall of Rome. But it's something that would be used to try to get the truth out if you survived. Paul had already been beaten by rods on three occasions at this point, and he's been sentenced to a disciplinary lash, which is not the flagellum at all, but it's given by the priests of the temple. It's pretty much where you're lashed five times, probably still not a very pleasant experience. But again, none of those were as severe as the flagellum and what they were about to do to him. And the thing is that, I mean, they barely knew this guy. He had done nothing really wrong. He'd upset a bunch of people, but didn't really do anything wrong. And that kind of tells you how willing the Romans were wanting to use torture to get the truth out and to keep the peace there in Rome. The whole idea of Pax Romana is one of those things where Roman peace, yes, it was peaceful, but it came at an extreme cost for anyone who wanted to rebel against Rome. But anyway, verse 25, Paul fortunately has one more trick up his sleeve. As they were stretching him out, what they were doing, and again, I would reference Outlander. I mean, there's other movies too, but Outlander and Jamie Frazier, where you have the pole that's put in front of you, or it's probably, of course, already in the ground. Your wrists are strapped together. You're then with your wrist tied up against the pole, where you're kind of stretched out to where everything is fully exposed. So that's what they were doing. They were setting him up to be tortured in that way. But fortunately, right at the right time, not sure why he didn't do this earlier, he brought out the whole Roman citizen, that he is a Roman citizen, and you cannot torture a Roman citizen without a trial, a fair trial, and that trial must convict that person. And this was based on the Valerian and Porcian laws that they had at that time. And it actually went as far as saying that no Roman citizen could be tortured, even if they were found guilty. They would be put to death, which isn't torture. Non-Roman citizens is pretty much a free-for-all. You can do whatever you want with non-Roman citizens. But a Roman citizen had a lot of protections underneath those two laws. You kind of wonder then why more people did not claim that they were Roman citizens before getting flogged. And there's many ways to look at it. It's like, well, first of all, if they found out you were lying, they'd kill you anyway. So you're dead either way. I guess you're trying to hedge your bets if you wanted to. So most likely that would probably just scare people not to even do it, because if you bring it up, you have a good chance of, well, not a good chance, I mean, you do have a chance of surviving being beaten with the flagellum, but it is either way, probably not a good idea to do. Why would Paul do it? And how would they know? Most likely Paul had what is referred to him as a diploma, which is a kind of an official badge. I've heard it made out of bronze. I've also heard some people refer to it as kind of made out of a hard type of wax. But anyways, what it served is a birth certificate and a citizenship token. It's probably something they would carry around in whatever version of a pocket that they had back then, and would show it as needed, especially before they were going to get beat by somebody. And once they saw that's pretty much all hands off at that point. So with whatever he's able to, whatever he uses, be it that diploma or something else, he is able to persuade the centurion, of course, there, and then eventually the tribune, that he is a Roman citizen. And at that point, they have to be hands off of Paul. Verses 26 through 28, as you can imagine, with the Roman judicial system, if a Roman citizen is punished without a fair trial, bad things will happen to those who did it. That would include not only the soldiers who were actually doing the beating, but the centurion who is looking over it, or observing, or advising, anyways, overseeing it. And then you would, of course, have the tribune and anyone else who is tied to it, who is aware of it, would all be guilty of torturing a Roman citizen. And so bad things would happen, especially for those who are not real Roman citizens. So like Paul, what I mean by that is Paul was born as a Roman citizen. He did not pay for it as the tribune did. The tribune was kind of, you wouldn't say on lease, is a very nice favor. I mean, it was mainly, well, I don't know if you'd call it a nice favor, because they had to pay typically a significant bribe in order to become a Roman citizen if they had to buy into it. So he probably paid a pretty fair penny into becoming a Roman citizen. Anyways, it's not exactly the same as being born into it, and so they had to be careful with that. You have to wonder why this guy didn't think he was a Roman citizen already. Most likely probably because the people that really, really disliked this guy, and he probably thought he was this Egyptian marauder that had already rolled through a couple years before. That's some speculation on that. He probably did not look very Roman-like. If you think about it, he just got beat up pretty good by the crowd. And he's probably carrying his scars from other times and probably wasn't dressed very nice. And so he probably didn't even look like a Roman citizen. So as you can imagine, the tribune would be quite nervous, as he is the one who's in charge. And he was the one who had to account for anything that would happen to any Roman citizen in the area in which he in which he ruled. Now, what the tribune says here makes him sound, well, young, and also makes him sound naive and arrogant, because to say that he paid a large sum of money, insinuating that the cost to get into the club must have become much less expensive, and this riffraff who is standing next to him is able to get him, because he certainly does not look like the status of a Roman citizen. He still certainly doesn't have the dress, the stature, and everything like that, so they must just allow anyone in. And so that's kind of the point he's making there whenever he says, I paid a large amount to get in. I really, it's always like the country club thing, right? You want to pay a lot of money, or you don't want to, but you do pay a lot of money to get into a country club, and you don't like to hang out with the guys who play down at the county or the city club, because they're obviously not as good as you, and insinuating this sort of level of arrogance of what's going on here. Typically during the time of Claudius, the paying of a Roman citizenship became quite a thing. Like I said, it was mainly through bribes. So this guy, we eventually know he is known as Claudius, which isn't the same Claudius, but typically what they would do is when they paid for their Roman citizenship, they would take on the name of whoever the emperor was their first name, and then their second name would be something different. I can't remember, we'll get to it here in a second, Lystra or Lystras is his name. So anyways, he paid into it. And Paul, on the other hand, was a Roman citizen, born into as a Roman citizen. And some would say that meant his father, of course, was one as well, and possibly could have gone even further down the line. Somehow there's some sort of maybe connection to Tarsus that there is. I've seen some evidence of that. Most likely, either Paul's father or Paul's father's father became a citizen through some sort of services that were rendered to a Roman general or administrator there in Asia Minor, close to where Tarsus was. Some people say that maybe it was around Pompeii, around 66, 64 BC. So he probably was a Roman citizen for a significant amount of time. At least, well, of course he was for his entire life, but his family may have been citizens for at least, at this point, 100 years. So there's some things to put into that based on what we know is our current time period here. Verse 29, we get a therefore. In what we see here, so the tribune is put into quite a scary position for himself. As someone who is accused and about to punish a Roman citizen without a fair trial, he could have gotten in trouble just for tying Paul up. He could have gotten in trouble just for putting Paul in chains because he's a Roman citizen. So he has to answer to his own superiors and could be in trouble for just that. He didn't even have to torture Paul to get in trouble. He could have been in trouble just for, like I said, accusing Paul unfairly, chaining him, tying him up. Now, that did happen, and tribunes got away with it, and centurions did as well as other people, but those who were a little bit more on the right side of the law would make sure that they stayed as clean as possible. So the tribune at this point, for the most part, according to Roman law, must do whatever he possibly can to keep Paul safe, to protect Paul, and to really figure out what is going on. So as we go into verse 30, Paul is brought before the council of the Sanhedrin again, or Sanhedrin, and I like the ring. But in order for the Tribune to learn more about the situation is why he's brought before the council, because the Tribune wants to get to the bottom of it. Of course, the Tribune releases Paul from his bonds before the meeting, as in showing, it's more of a symbolic showing that Paul could just walk away at this point, as in there's nothing that he has done that would need him to be bound in any way or arrested in any way. And this is pretty much them just walking down the street or walking down. Like I said, if you remember from last time, the garrison's headquarters, the fortress, was connected by a set of stairs that led down into the temple. And so as they did the walk down, Paul could have kept on walking. Anyways, that's what we're seeing away, because he is ultimately a Roman citizen who has not been accused of any sort of wrongdoing, according to Roman law. The Tribune is not clear at all, of course, what Paul did, but most likely he has a sense that it has something to do with, of course, an offense against the Jewish religion. And, of course, the Sanhedrin, which is a makeup of Sadducees and Pharisees, would be the best people to be able to help identify exactly what Paul did. Based on his power and his level of office there in Jerusalem, he had the right to order the Sanhedrin to meet. And this was based on an agreement that the people of Jerusalem and Rome had to allow, even though the people of Jerusalem, the Jews for the most part, could do most anything they wanted to do, as long as they kept in peace, they did have to fall in step whenever the Romans ordered it. And so at this point, this garrison, this level of leadership in this province in which this Tribune is over, is a military administration and there in Jerusalem. And so they had the ultimate authority to keep the peace. There doesn't seem to be, there was a procurator there or anyone to that effect who would have oversight over the Tribune. And so the power of the authority, of course, was given to the Tribune. Throughout this time, Paul would be under the protection of the Roman military. And during the trial, he would be under protection of the military. So even if the Jews tried to attack him again, the Romans would have to do whatever they could. And they would do whatever they could to protect Paul. They had no problem shedding blood. And so as long as Paul's with the Roman soldiers, the council can't injure him in any way. And if they attempted to do it, they would most likely meet their own death, so they're probably pretty careful, at least for a while they are, until we get later on into chapter 23. All right, now we're in chapter 23. Paul goes now before the Sanhedrin under protection of the Roman military, and so let's read 1 through 5. Because it's about to get heated all over again, and we'll move on from there. Paul, looking at the council, said, "Brethren, I have lived my life with a perfectly good conscience before God up to this day." That is a very, very significant quote that Paul gives there. Brethren, of course, showing he's a fellow Pharisee, as part of that group is Pharisees. He's also a Jew, so he's showing that part as well. So we're seeing both of those things, but mainly it's that good conscience that he has kept. He has done whatever he could to stay on the right side of what God has asked him to do. Verse 2, "The high priest Ananias commanded those standing beside him to strike him on the mouth. Then Paul said to him, 'God is going to strike you, you whitewashed wall. Do you sit to try me according to the law, and in violation of the law, order me to be struck?'" The law that he's referring to is Jewish law. "But the bystander said, 'Do you revile God's high priest?'" Paul did not know that. This is very interesting how this gets so complicated. "And Paul said, 'I was not aware, brethren, that he was a high priest,'" or he was high priest, "'for it is written, you shall not speak evil of the ruler of your people.'" That's a reference back to Exodus 22, where he gets into the laws related to that. So this already starts off pretty heated. He doesn't get a whole lot. He gets a sentence out, and then he gets smacked by one of the temple guards. We assume that's who he's close to, or close enough to, that would strike him. Most likely all the priests were kind of probably on a higher platform looking down there on Paul and the Romans. So Paul, again here in verse 1, makes a claim that he has made before. He has lived a life of good conscience, a bold claim, but one that seemed to be true. He'll make that claim again in front of Felix, the procurator. in chapter 24. This claim is to be a witness to his behavior, but we also know from Paul that this righteousness is not of his own making, but from a higher court, a higher than the priestly court, higher than the council, but of course from a heavenly court, the court of God. In verse 2, the claim did not sit, of course, well with the chief of the Sanhedrin, or the chief priest. In that time, it was Ananias. Ananias was the son of Nedabeus, who received the priestly office from Herod of Chalcis, the younger brother of Herod Agrippa. So there's a little bit of a connection there. All this is pretty incestual whenever you look down into it, a lot of bribes. And it's not, though the office is powerful, it is not a group of what we refer to as moral people based on how they would do it. I guess they probably had some levels of morality, but for the most part, it was pretty crooked. So this guy was appointed probably about 47 AD and held the office for the next 12 years. He was known to Ananias was known to steal from the common priests by taking their tithes, which is according to the historian Josephus. So he was known to not only beat up on Roman citizens who he disagreed with, but also to steal from his very own priests that he was to actually to be served. At one point, it seemed like my son, I believe it was Josephus who reported this, that Ananias was caught up in a pretty much was complicit in a significant amount of bloodshed between the Judeans and the Samaritans, but he was cleared of this offense by Claudius, who was the emperor of that time. Most likely because Herod Agrippa advocated for him to be released from that. Even before becoming priest, he was a wealthy man with a lot of power. Even when he was out of priestly office, so even after he was no longer priest, he was known to assassinate those he did not agree with. So he had a lot of power both in and outside of this office in which he held. This ultimately does not go well for Ananias. He is known to be very pro-Roman in his policy, which of course, as you can imagine, upset the more zealot Jews, the less Roman-friendly Jews. And we know we're right on the cusp right now of the next Jewish revolt, which ultimately ends very bad for the people of Jerusalem. And that is when the temple is destroyed in 70 AD. So we're right on the cusp of that. It was in 66 AD, which is only a couple of years from right now, when the war broke out against Rome, whenever there was that major revolt against Rome. When this happens, the Jews who were living there, who did not like him at that time, dragged him out of this aqueduct that he was hiding in. I believe they brought his sons out too. No. It was his brother. Brought them out and killed them there. His son, who was captain of the temple guard, seemed to be just as evil as Ananias, actually killed the people who killed his father. So great, great family, as you can imagine, based on how this is all playing out. So enough of backstory there of Ananias. We know that he was a great man, as in powerful, but not a great man, as in a good man. As we go into verse 3 here, Paul does not, of course, as you can imagine, Paul does not back down from this. He is not a man who likes to be struck in the face, no matter what his situation is. I can imagine most people would not. This caught Paul, you can imagine, it probably caught him pretty much off guard. As the Pharisee of Pharisees, he knew the law of the Jews. He knew the traditions. He knew everything related to how a Jew should live, as well as the legal side of this. And he knew that this type of behavior was not allowed to strike someone in this way before they were trialed. He knows that those accused were protected by the law until proven guilty. And Ananias, who seemed to have a record of this, broke the Jewish law and had Paul struck. So Ananias really could care less about Jewish law related to this, it seems, as in he's been known to do this before through assassinations and other physical evil exercises that he's done to other people. This is very similar to the situation that Jesus found himself in. If you were to go back to John 18, 21 through 23, both he and Paul protest against the illegality of the way the council was acting. Both times the council was acting unlawful according to Jewish law, and both times it did not end well for the person that was happening to. The reference here to the whitewashed wall, I believe, is coming out of Ezekiel, and what pretty much what he's referring to is, I believe, what Ezekiel was talking about, of a wall that is built that is not sturdy, that is tottering over, and they go ahead and paint it anyways to make it look like it's better than what it is, kind of disguise it. And much like this, that is what he is saying about Ananias, which seems to be very fitting. He is someone who would eventually is going to come to a bad end, as we know that he's going to be pulled out of an aqueduct and killed, even though at this time he looked in like he could do whatever he wanted, wherever he wanted, and did not have to worry about that. So this is quite prophetic of what Paul is saying here, based on how it would end for Ananias. Verses 4 and 5, as you can imagine, there's a lot of people who are surprised here. And of course, the people on the council who, again, know the Roman law, the Jewish law and how the Jews should respond to priests, are quite surprised by Paul's words, as that is not how you speak to a high priest. They seem to have become used to the way of Ananias, as in, this is just how this guy acts, and, you know, hey, he's slapped a lot of people around or told people to slap other people around, and so this is just the way he works. He's a complete pain for everyone, but he's powerful, and there's really, if we ever talk against him, he'll probably just kill us, so hey, let's all go along. It's kind of how that feels. Paul seems to apologize here, but it's not to Ananias, but to the office of the high priest. As he has respect for the latter, but not the former. And it much goes with, if you think of government offices today, if you don't particularly like the person who is in office, you can dislike that person. You don't hate them, but you dislike what they stand for, what they believe in. But you never disrespect the office, the spirit of the office. And that's what I think Paul is trying to get at here, is that, okay, I fully respect that though you're not acting like a high priest, the office of the high priest, that position is to be respected. As usual, Paul is willing to submit to Jewish law, as stated in, I believe, like I said, it was Exodus 22:28, where Moses said that it is illegal to revile the ruler of the people. So he is apologizing for reviling the office of high priest. But he does really care less about Ananias, it seems. And I can understand that. He does not seem to be a good man. It is interesting to see, though, that Paul did not recognize Ananias as a high priest, because typically they would wear, typically the high priest was running the meeting, so they would start it. And then typically they wore certain vestments that would identify them as the high priest. So that he did not recognize it is just interesting. possibly Paul did not see who said, strike him. Or maybe he was looking down or away or something would distract. I don't know. We don't know. Some people have said that could be why he said what he said, because he didn't know it was the high priest. could have been that the council got together so quickly that they did not dress in the correct vestments. Maybe Ananias was taking a bath and he ran over in his robe. I don't know. So that's another speculation of how did he not know that who the high priest was. So possibly he was not wearing what the high priest would wear. We have to also remember that so Paul's been gone for about 20 years at this point. He probably didn't recognize some of the people on the council. Now, some of his old friends from when he studied under Gamaliel and when he was persecuting Christians, he probably, you know, his old drinking buddies, he saw them, but there are probably other people on the council that he did not know who they were, and one of them could have been Ananias. So anyways, as we go on here, that was the end of verse 5, so let's look into verses 6 through 11 and go from there. But perceiving that one group were Sadducees and the other Pharisees, Paul began crying out in the council, brethren, I am a Pharisee, a son of Pharisees. I am on trial for the hope and resurrection of the dead. That is really controversial if you know anything about Sadducees. As he said this, there occurred a dissension between the Pharisees and Sadducees, and the assembly was divided. For the Sadducees say that there is no resurrection, nor an angel, nor a spirit, but the Pharisees acknowledge them all. And there occurred a great uproar, and some of the scribes of the Pharisaic party stood up and began to argue heatedly, saying, "We find nothing wrong with this man. Suppose a spirit or an angel had spoken to him." That's interesting how things have turned. And as the great dissension was developing, the commander was afraid Paul would be torn to pieces by them and ordered the troops to go down and take him away from them by force and bring him into the barracks. But on the night immediately following, this is really quick, crazy stuff. Let's drag Paul back up to the garrison, up into the barracks. But on the night immediately following, the Lord stood at his side and said, "Take courage, for as you have solemnly witnessed my cause at Jerusalem, so you must witness at Rome also." So another word of encouragement and hope for Paul there, that he is going to make it out of Jerusalem alive and that all will be okay. Well, at least he's going to survive. It may be painful, but he's going to survive. So Paul plays his cards a bit differently. So jump back up to verse 6 here. After the response of Ananias, knowing that the Sanhedrin contained, for the most part, part Pharisees and part Sadducees, he now addresses the group as a Pharisee. As a Pharisee, much like he approached the Tribune as a Roman citizen. So he's trying to relate with them and saying, "Hey, Tribune, you can't flog me. I'm a Roman citizen, much like you." Well, not much like you, actually more so than you. But anyways, and then, "I'm a Pharisee of Pharisees, a son of Pharisee. I'm not the only Pharisee. My dad was a Pharisee." So we see that. And Paul obviously knew the difference that the Pharisees and the Sadducees knew about the resurrection. And and the Pharisees believed in such a thing, of course, as the resurrection, while the Sadducees did not. We can't look at this as Paul trying to divide the group, but instead of him being consistent in his belief regarding the resurrection of Jesus, the Jewish Messiah, he's trying to help them understand that Jesus, the Jewish Messiah, was real, and that's what he is following, believing, living and almost dying for, was this faith that he had. And he's connecting with the Pharisees who believe, "Oh, well, it is possible. It is possible that there was a resurrection, because we do believe that happens and there are angels and things related to, and spirits." So we got to think about that. So less than 30 years before this encounter is when the Messiah had been resurrected. And Paul brings that into equation, but he also ties it into the resurrection of the dead, as he states in 1 Corinthians chapter 15, verses 16 to 17. Where we see he believes that if Jesus was not resurrected, then their faith is futile. That's what you see from 1 Corinthians 15, is that if the resurrection did not happen, then there's no even reason for us to even be here. It is just pure futility that we have this sort of faith in this dead guy. No. It's that Jesus was resurrected, and it is fully true, and that is true. Of course, so the idea of the resurrection was much harder on the Sadducees than the Pharisees. As the Sadducees, if they were to want to believe that Jesus was the Jewish Messiah and Jesus was in fact resurrected, they would have to turn away from all of their Sadducee beliefs. They'd have to denounce their basic tenets to follow Christ, while the Pharisees would not, because, there's a resurrected guy, and we believe in resurrection as a group, so this is possible. Well, this is for the most part true until the end, where the Pharisees could kind of go along with this up until the end of the first century, when the Jewish Christians were barred from being in the synagogue. And so you had kind of even a larger divide and disconnect between the folks in the synagogue and the Jewish Christians. verses 7 and 8. The Sadducees were immediately upset at what Paul was saying, while the Pharisees now thought, "Paul, hey, this guy is not that bad. Maybe it's very possible what this guy is saying has some sort of truth to it. He possibly cannot be as evil as these crazy Sadducees are saying." You could just wonder that the Pharisees and Sadducees disliked each other so much, especially on this one thing, that they were willing to even turn against fellow members of the council to start going along with this guy, Paul, who is now not even truly a Pharisee. I mean, he is raised up a Pharisee. He was a Pharisee. Maybe, I don't know how they would classify it at that point, but he was a post-Pharisee. And it's just crazy to see how that all kind of plays out. The people who are reading this for the first time, so when Luke wrote this, and it would mainly be Gentiles who would be reading this for the first time, at least that's our understanding, would not understand the differences of the Sadducees and the Pharisees, or probably were not familiar with it. And so what Luke is doing here by telling us this part of it is providing us a bit of context there in verses 7 and 8. So like I said, the Sadducees do not believe in the resurrection, but they also do not believe in the spirit world of angels and demons, and the Pharisees believed in angels, demons, resurrection, and everything like that. So there is more than just resurrection that they disagreed on. The Sadducees would believe that the true Jews, they were the true Jews. The Pharisees were probably not quite heretics, but were pretty close to it. But the Sadducees truly believe that they were the true Jews tied to the old orthodoxy of Israel. And you could say that they thought the Pharisees were a bunch of posers who didn't really quite get it. It could be like how we still have disagreements in the church today is that those in the mainline church for those versus those in the Bible churches, it's like this is real church and that is church light. And that's kind of what it felt like. And in some cases, it does still feel like that. But that was probably one way you could look at that. You got to remember the Sadducees would refer to the Pharisees as Pharisees, and because that would be referred to as separated ones, which also meant, I believe the word was Persianizers, which ties some of them to Persia, on the idea that Pharisees imported Zoroastrianism into the religion of Israel, which was tied back to Persia at that time. What the Pharisees believed eventually became the normative in Judaism. So eventually the Pharisees won out, while eventually the Sadducees were deemed to those who did not share the age to come based on their lack of belief in resurrection. So eventually the Pharisees, it seems, won out, and the Sadducees kind of went away because they did not believe in the Messiah, in the Jewish Messiah, even if there had been one that showed up or not. They believed that there never would even be a resurrected Messiah. That's clear as mud. We could probably talk hours just about the differences between Sadducees and Pharisees and how they came up. But just like most everything we're having to study here, we are working through a lot of just kind of high level stuff here. Okay, sorry. verses 9 and 10. Verses 9 and 10. What we see here is a disagreement from the most part kept the Tribune from getting the information that he was after. So another blown up trial that happens here with the Sadducees and Pharisees, or with the council, or with the Jews trying and the Tribune trying to get some sort of information from these people. The Pharisees, as we look at this, go as far as saying maybe Paul is right. We're in verses 9 and 10. And it's very possible he received a vision from or a word from an angel or some sort of spirit. What we can see from what Luke is writing is that he thinks the Pharisees are not as bad as sometimes depicted and are closer to the true form of Judaism, possibly not even that far away from the kingdom of God. So Luke seems to put the Pharisees, and maybe because Paul was a Pharisee at this point, he seems to put him in a nicer light than he does the Sadducees. We can possibly take from this that Luke thinks there possibly could still be a bridge between the Pharisees and the Jewish Christians. The Pharisees just need to realize that Jesus was the Messiah. I mean, if they just would make that one step, then they would see that Jesus was the Messiah, all things are good, and they can all go forward. So we are not going as far here as based on their reaction of the Pharisees in these two verses that the Pharisees agree that Jesus was the resurrected Messiah, because, of course, they do not at this point. They are, however, admitting that Jesus' spirit could still be alive and awaiting resurrection, as in Jesus was a prophet, a good man, did prophetic things, is now dead, and much like other dead people, spirit still resides there amongst them and around them. And this spirit came to Paul, talked to Paul on the road to Damascus. And if they believed Jesus was the resurrected Messiah, you'd have to think they could no longer be a Pharisee on the council. So they have a kind of a rub too. So I don't think they're making that leap here at this point, but they are admitting that possibly Jesus' spirit still was existing, was still around, and possibly connected with Paul. Verse 11, we get a vision of hope there to Paul. The Lord comes to Paul in a vision at night, receiving an encouraging word that for the most part he says he will make it out of Jerusalem alive, maybe slightly worse for the wear, but he will survive the time, similar to what we see in chapter 18, verse 9, when Paul was getting beat up in Corinth. There is a similar sort of vision of hope that Jesus sends to Paul. You could imagine that at this time, Paul probably felt a bit dejected, with little hope of something good coming out of this trip. It seems like he'd get little help from the people in Jerusalem, and he seems to not, which is true. He does get a little bit of help here in the next couple of verses, but for the most part, it wasn't going to be a great, fruitful time, at least immediately there in Jerusalem. The vision that of the Lord gives Paul hope and a reason to continue his time in Jerusalem, though it will be a short time, which is possibly to be another 2 years, a time of significant delay and anxieties as he navigates the Jerusalem church. So it's hard to sometimes tell the time until you start putting some pieces and parts together from other, from some of the epistles, as well as just history that we know of that time period, so some outside the Bible type historical documents. But it seems like Paul was there for another 2 years, at least at that point. At least that's what I've been able to see. As we go into verses 12 through 15, Paul, let me just read it. When it was day, the Jews formed a conspiracy and bound themselves under an oath, saying that they would neither eat nor drink until they had killed Paul. There's going to be a lot of hungry Jews running around. There were more than 40 who'd formed this plot. They came to the chief priests and the elders and said, "We have bound ourselves under a solemn oath to taste nothing until we have killed Paul. Now, if therefore you and the council notify the commander to bring him down to you as though you were going to determine his case by a more thorough investigation, and we for our part are ready to slay him before he comes near the place." So, a conspiracy forms. They have the best plan in place. They think they're going to take this guy out now. They're going to trick those Romans. Those Romans are going to bring that guy down. And you got to think, these guys are nuts to even be thinking this, because anyone under Roman guard, they're going to lose. Of those 40 people, you probably have about 4 left, based on how vicious and how well-equipped and how willing to do whatever they needed to do to preserve the peace the Romans were. So another plot to kill Paul, which is another pattern that Luke is showing us. The Jewish zealots, like I say, as you can see here, are about 40 in this instance, and they're still very upset with Paul. And they're upset again that Paul has slipped through their hands, the second time that has happened here. They took a covenanted oath at this point, where they swore solemnly that they would not eat or drink until they had killed Paul. This was similar to what you see in the Old Testament, something to the effect of, "So may God do to us and more also if we eat or drink anything until we have killed Paul." So they really think that God is on their side here and are willing to kill this Paul guy for being a heretic, lack of a better way to look at it. And so they go to the chief priests and they go to those who are in the council, who they know dislike Paul significantly, and ask for a favor to be granted to them to fulfill this evil task. It doesn't say if he actually fulfills it, but it seems like, well, it is allowed here at this point. We can assume that there are probably no Pharisees in this group of elders that were surrounding the chief priest, as in they were, because it seems based on the previous verses that they were a little bit more okay with this Paul guy, and so it's probably mainly the Sadducees who had been embarrassed again by Paul. We can also assume, like I said, that these guys, though they were zealots, though they were very zealous, and there were 40 of them, they were not dumb. They knew who, the power of the Romans, and so they probably went in knowing and expecting heavy losses. And the chance of many of them dying would be pretty high. So they knew what they were wanting to do. They were so impassioned to do this, to take this Paul out. You have to think, though they're seemingly to us evil in many ways, to them they think they are justified in this because they are trying to protect their own faith. They're trying to protect it from another heretic. And they've had many heretics run through the temple, and they have one more, another guy coming in, trying to ruin their day. And they're trying to protect their power. They're trying to protect their beliefs, their religion, and their traditions. And the only way they know how to do that is by killing Paul. So you have to kind of look at it from that perspective, is that they're not fully evil. What they're wanting to do is not great. They're trying to preserve the life that they know, much like people do to this day and have done since the beginning of time. Sometimes it goes well, and sometimes it doesn't. Most of the time, if you kill somebody, it does not go well for anyone, no matter how good it feels at the time. It's still pretty bad that it even got to that point in the first place. So anyways, verses 16 through 22, this is not as painfully long as you think it feels like. But anyways, as we go through here, but the son of Paul's sister heard of their ambush. What? Paul has a sister? She has a son? He has a nephew? Isn't this great? It's great how Luke just kind of throws these sort of details in. Anyways, and he came and entered the barracks and told Paul. Paul called one of the centurions to him and said, "Lead this young man to the commander, for he has something to report to him." So he took him and led him to the commander and said, "Paul, the prisoner, called me to him and asked me to lead this young man to you, since he has something to tell you." The commander took him by the hands and, stepping aside, began to inquire of him privately, "What is it that you have to report to me?" And he said, "The Jews have agreed to ask you to bring Paul down tomorrow to the council, as though they were going to inquire somewhat more thoroughly about him. So do not listen to them, for more than 40 of them are lying in wait for him, who have bound themselves under a curse not to eat or drink until they slay him. And now they are ready and waiting for the promise from you." So the commander let the young man go, instructing him, "Tell no one that you have notified me of these things." Dun, dun, dun. The plot thickens. Paul has a young ally. Maybe there's a few of them. I don't know. But at least he has a nephew who's willing to stand up for Paul and to go. It's you wonder how the word of mouth happens at this point. Like, was he in the court? Was he around the court? Where he was? There's this thing N.T. Wright's brought up called the Jerusalem telephone. I believe it's Arabic telephone. Anyways, it's this idea that news travels very fast in those communities, and it's almost like as soon as something is said, someone overhears it, and it just spreads like wildfire. And so that possibly could have been happening, or it just kind of depends. We may look at a few options here in a second. So we're introduced to the nameless nephew who had a nameless daughter or mother who is, I guess, a nameless sister of Paul's. Possibly those who are reading this knew who they were, so maybe they didn't. Maybe Luke didn't put the names in because he's like, "Oh, they know old so-and-so and so-and-so and so-and-so's son, so we don't need to say what this is." Or maybe it just didn't matter and we're just moving on from there. Again, like I said, why would the nephew be around in this situation? Some people have said, not on a happy note, is that some of Paul's relatives who were Pharisees or part of that Pharisaic group weren't super happy with Paul. They're still pretty bitter by it, and that he was a traitor to the faith. So he most likely was disinherited because of his faith in the Jesus as Messiah when he believed in that. So there could be just some bad blood, and one of the nephews who didn't have as much bad blood towards Paul heard this and wanted to help Paul, while there were some other family members there in Jerusalem who were there and wanted to. I don't know. I mean, they were from Tarsus, but remember, Paul studied in Jerusalem under Gamaliel. And so maybe the nephew had come to study too, not necessarily under Gamaliel, but someone else. And he was there. And he was an intern in the council. The options are limitless. It could be that the sister had a fondness towards Paul, and instead of the bitterness, the fondness, and this was passed on to her son. And like I said, he was studying there in Tarsus, in Jerusalem, from Tarsus, and wanted to help. Ultimately, we do not know, but we can always throw these fun stories together, and hopefully, they make a mini series out of it. So, verses 17 through 22, as an unconvicted Roman citizen, Paul was held in special care in. Referred to as the garrison or the fortress, is referred to as the Antonia fortress. And he was, of course, allowed visitors and was given special privileges. So it wouldn't be odd for a relative or a friend to come in and provide food or water, because the Romans didn't, other things that Paul would need. And so not a big deal for that to happen. It wasn't like he snuck in to do it. The centurions would take heed to whatever Paul would ask. So it was not a big ask for Paul to want the nephew to be taken to the tribune. So they're willing to do whatever they need to for Paul. So Paul will kind of stand there on his side so they don't report him to Felix that, hey, these guys try to kill or try to flog me before putting me on trial. So they seem to be pretty nice to Paul, at least on the surface they do. We get a sense that the tribune is a bit amicable to such an interruption, which is probably not the case most of the time, as he was a person of high importance, but again, goes back to Paul and the story of Paul. Then again, it seems like throughout, Luke speaks well of tribunes, no matter how negative they were. And so maybe Luke just liked to write positive about tribunes. So who knows how this guy really responded, but he responds, and nonetheless, an action is taken. Verses 23 through 24, and he called to him two of the centurions, said, get 200 soldiers ready by the third hour of the night to proceed to Caesarea with 70 horsemen and 200 spearmen. They were also to provide mounts to put Paul on and bring him safely to Felix the governor. So those are verses 23 and 24. So after hearing the message of the nephew, the tribune prepares to get Paul out of town to head over to Caesarea. The tribune is probably super excited about this because he is tired of having Paul under his control, because if anything happened to Paul, he would be in big, big trouble. And so he understands that Paul is not safe in Jerusalem, even under Roman lockdown or Roman arrest or Roman protection, and he needs to get out of there as quickly as possible. The tribune cannot have an unconvicted Roman citizen's blood on his hands. It would not help his status nor help his progression up the government ladder. So he orders a strong guard to ensure Paul's safe trip, as well to ensure that he will not be blamed for any harm that comes to Paul on his way to see Felix in Caesarea. They go by night. Which makes a lot of sense. It's a very well-armed and trained group. You would not want to meet these guys in the dark. The trip to Caesarea is about 60 miles, so they gave horses and mules to Paul to ensure that it's a pretty quick trip. For those of you who are a little bit curious about this, the light-armed troops were possibly, based on the Greek that's being used, are probably javelin throwers or slingers, sort of slingshots. Pretty much is derived from the Latin word, it's a Greek word, desiobolus, which means throwing with the right hand. And anyways, about 200 soldiers go, leaving about 800 or so back in the garrison. So they typically had about 1,000 there because it was a pretty large military province. So 200 go, 800 stay. And as we look at these verses 25 through 30, this letter is sent to Felix. So Claudius Lysias, we get his name for the first time. He writes a letter to the most excellent governor, Felix. Great Felix, greetings. When this man was arrested by the Jews and was about to be slain by them, I came up to them with the troops and rescued him, having learned that he was a Roman. Is that true? He may have pulled things out of context, or not, you know, changed the story a bit. And wanting to ascertain the charge for which they were accusing him, I brought him down to their council. And I found him to be accused over questions about their law, but under no accusation deserving death or imprisonment. When I was informed that there would be a plot against the man, I sent him to you, at once also instructing his accusers to bring charges against him before you. So as we see here, this is a very typical form letter that would be written between two leaders of two different provinces, or from a probably better said from a tribune to a procurator. So soldiers, in accordance with their orders, took Paul and brought him by night to Antipatris, which is probably about halfway, probably a kind of a rest stop between there. But the next day, leaving the horsemen to go on with him, they returned to the barracks. When these had come to Caesarea and delivered the letter to the governor, they also presented Paul to him. When he had read it, he asked from what province he was from, and when he learned that he was from Cilicia, he said, "I will give you a hearing after your accusers arrive also," giving orders for him to be kept in Herod's praetorium. Those are pretty nice digs, by the way, where they were able to put Paul while he waited for the accusers to show up. And we'll see here in a second that Felix is about to boot this can down the road. But anyways, that'll be next time. We do it in chapter 24. So as we summarize this, the Tribune, of course, sends a letter about Paul's situation to Felix. It is hard to believe that Luke had an exact copy of the letter, so it was determined that he most likely made it up. He does actually act as if it's a verbatim copy. I would say it was typical back then to recreate a letter like this and to send it as in if it was written and you had access to it. Writers back then would do that. It was kind of a typical way to make a point, to be able to get the message across. Anyways, possibly he could have had access to the letter at a later time, but we don't know that either. Either way, he writes it in a very similar fashion of a formal letter that would be written in that day. And all that seems to be pretty good until we get to the twist of the truth there in verse 27. Before we get there, Luke gifts us with the Tribune's name at this point for the first time. Based on this, he is obviously Greek, Claudius Lysias. His original family name was Lysias or Lysias, but was most likely given the name Claudius when he became a Roman citizen. And it was the name, of course, that of Claudius, the emperor who was ruling during that time. The proper use of the title, most excellent, that he gives to Felix gives us a little bit more context about Felix being part of the equestrian order, or the order of knights there in the Roman society. These typically were the folks who were brought to rule over Rome provinces there in Judea. We'll learn a little bit more about Felix here in a minute. Verses 27 through 30 give us a summary from Lysias to Felix of what happened in the temple and how Paul's life was threatened. This unaccused, innocent Roman citizen that Lysias, the way he makes it sounds, rescued this man and saved him from death and has kept him safe in order to deliver him to the great and most excellent procurator Felix. Recall he learned about Paul being a Roman citizen not while rescuing Paul, but whilst Paul was being prepared to be flogged. When Paul brought up the centurion, the tribune had already left the scene. A key detail that needed to be shared in order to keep himself safe. So his letter was written in a way to make him look good, be honest. The tribune makes it clear that through the meeting with Sanhedrin that Paul did not break a Roman law, but instead some Jewish religious law about the Messiah, blah, blah, blah. Didn't really know what exactly it was. Couldn't really get a clear answer. These Jews are crazy. And I'm just reporting what I know. Paul did nothing against the sanctity of the temple, which would have been, which can lead to severe punishment. And it's brought up again in chapter 24 when he's before Felix. But now that could have been something if Paul had done something against the temple, defiled it in some way. If you remember when was it? I can't remember. But if you were to bring a Gentile into the inner walls of the temple where only Jews were allowed, that could be pretty bad, or any sort of vandalism or anything like that. So it could have happened, but Paul didn't do that, and he makes it clear. But for the safety of this Roman citizen who Lysias so gratefully and gracefully saved, he must be sent to Felix and put on trial there, for the most part, to save Paul, but also to save the standing of Lysias. Last few verses, 31 through 35, Paul is taken to Caesarea. Like I said, that's probably about 60 miles away, 60 miles to the north. It kind of goes, it's down because, you know, Jerusalem, of course, is up on the mountain, goes kind of this way and then back up that way, up towards close to the coast, to meet with Felix and the Sanhedrin, is there to follow the council at least, and he will remain there for the foreseeable future there in Caesarea once he makes it there. They left the third hour of the night, so that would be around 9 o'clock. So the first hour is 6, so 9 o'clock would be when they would have left. Most likely is probably a quick forced march because Antipatris, like I said, is probably about 30, 35 miles away. And some people say the troops, the foot soldiers or the infantry did not go all the way. They probably made it a good way out of town until they felt like there's no way that anyone could catch up with them. And then they headed back. Maybe they didn't go all the way to Antipatris. Maybe they did. Anyways, there is still a cavalry, which was with Paul, which was very much suitable to take out anybody who tried to want to attack them and attack Paul. They overdid it, probably lack of a better word. Anyways, and a little bit about Antipatris. It was it was at the foot of the Judean hills, was built by Herod the Great. He named it after his father. Antipater, it was a well-watered and well-wooded area. Seems like a nice resting spot. So, with only 27 miles left to go, the infantry headed back, and the cavalry took Paul the rest of the way. They're relatively safe country between Jerusalem and Caesarea. They don't have to worry about any Jewish insurrection. It's mainly a Gentile country that they're in. So he'd be relatively safe. I mean, as safe as you can be on the roads during that time. But in Rome, with a bunch of Roman soldiers surrounding you, you're pretty safe. And in pretty much any Roman province, at least for that time period. So Paul makes it there, verses 33 through 35. Paul makes it there to Caesarea, is presented along with a letter to Felix. And Felix asks which province Paul is from, determine if the authorities of the province should be part of this conversation, because if he was from a different province that Felix did not have power over, then they would have to take care of this issue. So the reason he did this is that he didn't want to do anything with it. He didn't want to deal with Paul. He's hoping to pass this on, is the belief. And we see that as we read through Felix before we get to Festus, that Felix didn't want to have anything to do with this guy. So he asked this, hoping that, oh, please, don't be in a province that I have control over. The last Paul was, and so he had to. So it was okay. So he didn't have to send him off. Paul would have to do that, and so he was blah, blah, blah. Felix agreed to do the trial, but would wait, of course, until the council showed up. Paul was set up in the procurator's headquarters, which has been built by Herod the Great, is known as the Praetorium, and is considered to be a very nice and costly building / facility. And so that's where he was placed for a while. Felix's full name, because I know you're just dying to know what it was, Marcus Antonius Felix. Oh, what a strong Greek Roman name that is. Most likely he was born as a slave and advanced up through the ranks, so he's even less of a bigwig than, if you really look at how society looks, than Lysias was. And he was probably known to Claudius. Claudius probably liked Felix, and of course Felix's brother, who apparently helped Felix make his way up through society, because Pallas, who was Felix's brother's name, and Felix owed a lot to Claudius, and Claudius liked to put those sort of people in power that they owed so much personal debt to him that they would never, ever go against him. And so that's why people like this would make it into power. So his brother was a freedman of Claudius's mother, whose name was Antonia, and was the head of what we understand, the head of Claudius's imperial civil service. And Felix worked his way up through other provinces and eventually became procurator of Judea, probably about AD 52. And during this time is when the Jewish uprisings had really started to begin, causing him to be relatively severe with the Jewish people. So from AD 52 for the next 18 years was not a very fun, happy time between the Romans and the Jewish people, eventually ending in the destruction of, for the most part, Jerusalem and the temple in AD 70. Wow. And we made it through one more time. And next time it's going to be chapter 24. We'll probably go through most of it. We'll go through all of chapter 24 and then go into probably a lot of 25. First half, at least. Half-ish. Wow, we're almost done. Almost done. Thank you. Have a great day.
We hope you have enjoyed the podcast. For more information about our church, visit www.woodridge.org.